got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine. All the worries gonna leave my troubled mind. I've got a broken thing.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Biotech Facts and Fallacies podcast. I'm your host, Cameron English. As you all know, social media can be kind of a cesspool because people surround themselves with people that think just like them, and you get sort of an echo chamber effect. And then even worse, those same people will go and attack other people that disagree with them for most cases, no good reason. So today I'm talking to a scientist named Mary Mangan, who goes out of her way on Twitter to interact with people that disagree with her, even if they call her a shill or they just insult her or make fun of her, because she's trying to promote science literacy. And the best way to do that, of course, is to interact with people, especially if they dislike what you're saying. So I want to get some insight from Mary about how you communicate with people in a setting like that. And then we're also going to talk about a recent situation where this anti-GMO activist named Mike Adams, who formed a website called Natural News, was kicked off Facebook for spreading what Facebook called misinformation and content that was potentially dangerous because it was bad health advice. And so I want to get her opinion on how we balance free speech versus protecting the public, I suppose, from information that can be harmful. Mary has a PhD in cell molecular and developmental biology from the University of Rochester. She co-founded Open Helix, a company that provides awareness and training on open source genomic software. And of course, she's written dozens and dozens of articles about biotechnology and pesticides and GMOs. And I'm looking forward to our conversation. So thanks for tuning in. All right, Mary, welcome to the show. How are you today?
Oh, terrific. Thanks, Cameron. Thanks for the invitation. We've chatted on Twitter plenty of times, but I don't think we've ever talked in person.
This is a very, very big treat for me. I don't like basketball stars or football players. I like scientists, and so I get to talk to you. This is even cooler. So I always start these by asking why someone's passionate about what we're talking about. And so today we're talking about science communication and trying to reach the public when it comes to these controversial issues. And so I'm wondering, is there a moment or is there something in your experience as a scientist that made you want to get into this? And the reason I ask is because this is a while back now, but I remember figuring out how genetic engineering works just at a fundamental level. And I was so excited and I thought it was so cool. And it was clear right off the bat that people have really big misconceptions about how it works. And so I decided there, I'm like, okay, I'm going to focus my writing on this. This is really interesting. Do you have something like that?
I would actually put it back further. So we're going to go way back in time now. And it goes back to my love of biology. I became a biologist because I love biology. And I think that's one of the things that gets lost in a lot of the drama out there. People are telling us how much we hate the natural world and all this. And it's not that. We got into this because we love biology and we're fascinated by it. I was fascinated by tide pools as a kid. I could sit and watch for hours all the organisms interact at the tide pools. My family had a place up at Hampton Beach, New Hampshire, and I would sit for hours. Like, they had to come out and pull me in for lunch. They had to remind me to eat. This is how much I love biology. And it really put me on the path early on to science as a career track. And I definitely got more into that. And I got more into the responsibility of the being a scientist who had been provided with education from the state of Massachusetts. They gave me a scholarship to college and then other organizations like NIH grants and things like that. So I was being provided by the community with this great education, and I felt responsibility to do outreach on that and tell people about how much I love the biology and how fascinating it was and how many great different kinds of opportunities there were to study all kinds of different things. So I would say that's how it got started.
Okay, so this is from a young age, you made a decision that you're gonna do this for a living. And so when you get on a medium like Twitter, since you brought it up, there's some very colorful characters, we'll say, on Twitter these days.
Some people think I'm colorful too, yeah.
You are. You have a knack for interacting with people. It's not easy to do. I know that much. But are you starting from that experience when you try to talk to people, or does it change depending on the context of whatever topic is in discussion?
Yeah, it changes depending on the context. I don't use it as a strategy, I guess. I just talk about things I'm interested in, or things that I come across that are interesting. Or if I find people who have misconceptions, I'm happy to jump in and explain some of the things that they seem to have wrong. That has been fun and interesting. And I actually think that the discussions help me because I understand what people are asking or confused about, and I get better at answering those questions the more I do it. So it's kind of like a lab for me in that sense. Like I don't always have a specific strategy going in, but some of the same things come up over and over, and you get better at responding to those over time too. So I actually use Twitter jousting as a refinement mechanism, I guess.
Sure. Anything that doesn't kill you makes you stronger, sort of a thing.
Right,
and
right.
The reason I ask is because at Genetic Literacy Project, when we publish a story, we do our homework. You know, I've relied on you multiple times as a source for things that you're expert in. And we have to do that with everything and make sure we have every T crossed, every I dotted. You know, we have to make sure we have the facts in place. And then the story gets published. It goes on Twitter and other social media. And the first comments we get from certain people who shall remain unnamed are, well, you guys take money from industry, or, you know, you guys are corrupt, or X, Y, and Z, you know, you are, you're in league with the devil, whatever it is. You know, there's something right off the bat that's meant to discredit the story. And so for me as a journalist, that's irritating because I work really hard to tell the truth. But for you as someone who really knows the you know, biotechnology and agriculture to a certain extent, you know these topics really well. And so for someone to go, oh, well, you know, you're one of Monsanto's partners or something. I mean, how does that affect you? But how do you react to that? How do you navigate around that to keep the conversation going forward?
Yeah, there's sometimes that you can't ever convince somebody that their complete lack of evidence means there's nothing to charge me with. There are sometimes those you just have to ignore those crazy commenters and conspiracy theorists. But the thing is, when you're standing on the science, it's solid. You know, I never make claims that the science can't cash. You know, I have references. I have read all of these papers that we're talking about that are usually under discussion. And if I haven't read a paper, I don't make comments about it. So I feel like I can stand on the literature that's out there and the body of evidence that we have and the consensus of experts. And so there are plenty of things that make it solid. And then, you know, if somebody's got conspiracy theories, I ask them for evidence and then they never have any. So, you know, if they're not going to do that, eventually I just stop because they will just keep saying the same thing over and over again. And there's no value in that. But there are some people who have legitimate misconceptions, I guess. When I say legitimate misconceptions, I mean I understand how they've been lied to by people who are opposed to genetic modification. So they have some research that they've done that they've just got the wrong end of the stick on. And so there are occasionally good conversations where you can work some things out. Like just the other day, I was talking with someone about monocultures, and they said, but oh, well, don't GMOs cause monocultures? I said, well, there were monocultures before GMOs, and if there was no GMOs tomorrow, there would still be monocultures. And then, of course, you know, the goalposts move to another thing and another thing. But you can go through some of those things, and as long as somebody just doesn't start shouting shill at you, there are good conversations that can come out of it. So, and the good conversations outweigh the conspiracy theorists most of the time. So it's still worth doing to me.
That's a great example. And actually, since you mentioned monoculture, can you just briefly define what that is? Because I'm sure people have heard that term, but it's like if there's a top 10 bingo of like
right.
anti-GMO activism, that's probably like two or three.
I think there's so much confusion about it because people have heard the word monoculture and they use it like a dog whistle. And so what they think is all of the Midwest is covered with one kind of corn. you know, and that's not the case. There's actually local breeding going on for different types of corn that might grow better in southern parts of the U.S. rather than northern parts of the U.S. And there's different kinds of corn. Popcorn is a different kind of corn from other corns. And so I think a lot of what happens, the misconception of monoculture is anti-GMO activists think there's one kind of corn, and they've told their flocks that this is there's one kind of corn out there. But then you can start explaining to people that that is really just not the case. There are lots of different varieties. And one of the things that I've used in the past successfully to illustrate this is there was a seed catalog. I found a seed catalog, and it had a table of different corn varieties that a farmer could purchase, and they had different disease resistance, and they had different maturity dates, and they had different all kinds of different characteristics, different traits that a farmer could choose. And so I think that alone made the point that we're not just talking about one kind of corn out there. Although today there was a funny discussion on James Wong's Twitter feed. He was discussing something about monocultures, and there was a woman who was complaining about monocultures being a GMO thing. And I pointed out that, well, you know, French wine is a monoculture. If there's one kind of variety that you're growing over and over for many, many years, that could be considered a monoculture. But nobody thinks of French wine as a monoculture, French wine grapes as a monoculture, right? So I think part of it is what people think a monoculture is versus what it actually is. And there's been some good discussions of what monoculture could actually mean by Steve Savage.
Yes, plant pathologist, smart guy.
Yeah. So he had a really good blog post one time that went into details on what monocultures actually mean. So I would point people there for that.
Yeah, we'll link to it. And it's excellent. There's actually, believe it or not, as with everything in life, there's certain economic incentives that influence the decisions that growers make and that, plant breeders make and that these big seed companies make. And sometimes that gets rid of the conspiratorial taint that kind of, you know, covers these issues. And so if you can realize, you're like, oh, yeah, this is what you do because this is what people will buy. You know, it demystifies it a little bit. But while we're on the topic, I just thought of this. Are there any other issues that you come up against frequently on social media? And I'm sure you're probably tired of talking about them, but they're so common. Can you name off maybe one or two others and why you think those ideas are problematic?
Sure. And it's funny, too, because I've written this tweet multiple times, and it keeps coming up over and over, though. It's like a zombie. So everyone starts complaining about monoculture first, and then I talk to them about monocultures and how monocultures existed before, and there might be reasons that farmers want to do monocultures in some cases. But okay, so they say, okay, all right. So they move on from monocultures, and they say, well, patents. Patents are the second issue that they're all upset about. And then you explain, patents are not limited to GMOs, and there are GMOs that are off patent. And so you ask them, are you okay with GMOs that are off patent? And then they just move the goalposts again to something else. And then they hate herbicides, right? And then herbicides, but they have one particular hatred, which is, of course, glyphosate, which I've referred to as glypho hate.
Dun, dun, dun. That's the naughty word.
And the hatred of herbicides is so weirdly specific to this one herbicide that when you start explaining to people that other herbicides exist and that there were herbicides in use before GMOs and there would be after GMO, again, it's the same conversation. People use this, all of these things, as a proxy for their misunderstandings of agriculture. And those three things, I think, are the most frequent misunderstandings that keep coming up. There used to be another one, which I think has changed over the years. And I think it's because scientists got out in front of that, the Terminator gene thing. That used to come up when I first started getting into these discussions, that people were under the impression that there was a gene that existed in plants that would make sure that the farmers could not plant the seeds the next year. They call this Terminator. and I think that we largely swatted that misinformation down. The Terminator concept that people are talking about has never been in farmers' hands anywhere in the world. That one, I do think we managed to make people understand that it didn't ever exist, and it wasn't a grounded fear, you know?
Yeah. Well, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that was conceptualized as a way to address the concern that transgenic crops were going to, you know, quote unquote, spread and infect the natural world. Is that correct, that the companies thought of that as a way to address that concern?
I don't know about the initial direction of that. You would have to ask somebody else about that. But it is, an example of, okay, you're concerned about gene flow. How about if we had a way to not have gene flow? Would you support that? And then that was attacked too. Almost everything that we offer as an opportunity to solve some kind of problem, somebody comes at it from the other side and says, well, that's wrong because X, Y, and Z. And so every time we think that, you know, there's going to be something, well, this is the thing that consumers will like. For example, the GMO heme in the Impossible Burger is the newest one that I'm watching this happen to. So there's this genetically modified heme from soybeans that's been put into yeast for production that goes into this Impossible Burger. Now, instead of enjoying the fact that this might be reducing animal agriculture burdens on the planet, now everyone's complaining that it's a processed food. So I don't know. Every time we think there's something that you can explain as a benefit, somebody has a contrary opinion about it. And so this kind of conversation goes on constantly. So
what I'm wondering, and that's another great example, but what I'm wondering is this really just a political or philosophical concern? That's the best thing I can come to, is that whether the critic is on the left or the right, they either have a distrust of big government, quote unquote, or they have a distrust of big, insert whatever industry we're talking about, big food, big ag, big chemical, whatever. And so no matter, in some cases, no matter what you do to address their concern, you can't get at that foundation, which is I don't trust Monsanto, or I don't trust the FDA. They're trying to poison me with vaccines and GMO corn. So how do you deal with that? I've heard different answers. So I've had some scientists say, you know, I'm going for the bell curve. I'm going for the people that might be watching this interaction, or I just dismiss those people, or I talk to everybody. I mean, where do you fall on that spectrum of responses, do you think?
Yeah, I certainly think for some people it is a philosophical problem, and it's fine. If you want to have a philosophical problem with some kind of production process and you want to avoid that, that's okay. But you don't have the right to force that onto everyone else, in my opinion. Like, for example, there are food traditions that have specific rules around them. Kosher is an example of this. And it's perfectly fine to keep kosher and have kosher foods and have those kosher foods available and label those kosher foods in your third-party system so that people who want to have that can identify those. But you can't force that on the rest of the population, in my opinion. And that's why the system of third-party food philosophy things are fine with me. But what happens is the people who are making lots of comments, derogatory comments about GMOs, for example, you start discussing with them that this is a philosophy and it's fine to have your philosophy. But then they start trying to use science as the means to support for this. And they're using typically crap science to do this. They're using some papers that have come out from some really unusual scientific sources, I guess I would say. And so they're trying to brace their philosophy with bogus science claims. And that is something that we can't be making policy decisions based on people's philosophical food issues and bogus science that underlies it, you know? But there's two kinds of people. There's some people who are just not informed about the science, and that those folks can benefit from understanding more of the scientific details, like explaining the herbicide things more, or explaining that in sugar beets, GMO sugar beets, you're getting the same sugar out, whether it's sugar cane, sugar, sucrose, or whether it's sugar beets, you're going to get the same product out in the end. And there are some people who are reached with that, and that's not a philosophical problem then. But yeah, there's some people who just have a philosophy who will not ever accept it. And that's fine. But I just don't think that they have the right to demand farmers stop growing these things, if that's right for farmers or for whatever situation or for people who want to choose this. I wouldn't restrict anybody's opportunity to have these things. I am not ever going to say that people should not ever use or buy organic food or organic farms should be shut down. I will never make that statement. I don't support those and I don't buy those when I'm given a choice, but people have the right to do that. But they've overstepped when they've started to say farmers can't grow this. We can't have this. Nobody should have access to this. So.
And you'd mentioned just now that people don't have the right to spread misinformation. I think that's what you said. Don't let me misquote you if I did. But I wanted to get your thoughts on this real prominent anti-GMO conspiracy site, Natural News, getting pulled off Facebook. I believe this just happened yesterday. And the site was founded by a guy named Mike Adams, who's a very big activist in the natural health, natural foods world. And he said some truly goofy things. I mean, he's compared Monsanto to Nazi Germany, and he's said that, I don't want to say anything, he said that like certain fruit juices can cure cancer and just really strange things, and vaccines are poison and so forth. So I think both of us right off the bat would say, well, this guy clearly is in his own little universe and he's got his own little group of followers that are going to listen to this. But Facebook stepped in and they said, look, this is our platform and you're spreading silliness and so you're gone. And I have to be honest, frankly, I'm a little troubled by that. I'm, you know, there's some cognitive dissonance going on in my head. So I'm wondering what you think about that situation.
I understand that. And I do think that there are definitely free speech issues that they could shut down scientists at some point. I mean, but Mike Adams wanted to do that. He had a list and he was going to add scientists and journalists to that. So we would have both been on it. So I understand the hesitancy to restrict speech. But Mike Adams has his own website. He can still make all of these claims on his own website, in his newsletters that he's charging people money for and selling his products that he's charging more money for. Nobody has prevented that. But I think that if you have a platform like Facebook, then the people who own Facebook have the right to choose if they think there's dangerous rhetoric that could lead to harmful outcomes. I can understand why they will want to restrict some of that. He has provided misinformation on a whole bunch of topics, and some of it is really dangerous health misinformation. There are people who are refusing chemotherapy because of the kinds of things that he promotes. And these people are dying. There was just a story of a woman in the past week who had avoided all chemotherapy and died leaving a young daughter behind. And that's just tragic and unnecessary. And so there are real outcomes to this misinformation, real tragic outcomes. And I understand that there's a free speech aspect to it, but I also understand that platforms might choose what they want people to share and what they think shouldn't be shared. So.
Yeah, maybe someone with a little more legal expertise than either of us can weigh in on this. I don't feel qualified to really say this is good or bad. It seems like there's good and, you know, potentially awkward or negative aspects to this that need to be investigated. I did want to move on to another sort of activist personality, and the reason, of course, is that you crashed one of her meetings in your neck of the woods. And of course, I'm talking about Carrie Gillum, who is a former journalist for Reuters. Now she's the research director at this activist group called U.S. Right to Know, which is very much anti-biotechnology, and they are playing a real prominent role in these current lawsuits against Bayer, alleging that glyphosate causes cancer. And we've done two podcasts back to back on that. So we don't have to dig into the science on glyphosate, but I'm really curious about your experience going to her meeting. I believe she was talking about her book Whitewash, which I think you called Hogwash in your review. So tell me, because there's a video clip on YouTube, but it's only like 3 minutes and it's heavily edited to make you look worse than you really should have, I think. But Tell me about that experience. Let's start there.
So I had known about Carrie's book, but I refused to buy it and spend my money on it. So I waited for a while to get it out of the library. I borrowed it from my local library, and then I read it in detail and wrote a review on it on the website BioFortified. But before, I should say, before we posted the review, my editor, who's called Carl Haro von Mogel, he and I looked over the statements that I was making, and we thought that it would be wise and journalistically prudent to ask if Carrie or her publisher had any comments about some of the things that might be coming up in this review. So Carl created a list of 10 questions, sent it off to include both Carrie and her publisher, tried very hard to get them to respond to this before we posted. And eventually he did have a call with her publisher, I think. You would have to check the details with him. And the publisher refused to answer the questions and was not nice about returning our responses. So we never got the answers to these questions. And so we posted the review, and it got a lot of traction, I would say. And a lot of people realized that it was touching on a lot of the things that Carrie had either misrepresented or omitted in the book. And it was really the only review out there that covered some of these things. So I think it was popular. And I was actually getting calls from people who were digging into this subject a little bit to understand more about this. So it had a good resonance, I would say. Not only were a lot of people reading it, but it had downstream effects on people who were going to be writing about it or talking about it later. So anyway, so I was pleased with the way this review had gone, but I still wanted the answers to the questions. And so I saw a tweet that Carrie was going to be in my town. And I thought, well, look, there's an opportunity to ask some questions. And I wanted to see in person what a room full of people looked like that was enwrapped by this this information, and who comes to this, and who is, I don't know, who is supporting the kind of information that Carrie is driving. And so I wanted to know what the turnout would be like. I wanted to know who was going, and I wanted to hear what Carrie would have to say live. So I went to this. It was at a church in Cambridge, in Harvard Square, and I went to listen. I did not... I didn't have to buy a ticket. There was no ticket required. And so I walked in and sat down and listened through the whole thing. But of course, they opened the mic for questions at the end. And I came up and I said, "Hi, Carrie, I think you know who I am." And I, you know, introduced myself. And I told people that I had written this hogwash book review. And I said that I had this list of 10 questions that we would love for you to still answer. That didn't happen, of course. And the moderator said that I could ask one question. And I said, okay, I will ask one question. And my question was, how could you omit the science? If you said you're following the science on these things, why would you omit things? Why would you omit the 2-year National Academy of Sciences study that dealt with GMOs? And I specifically pointed out that there were also many mentions of glyphosate in that document. So this is the 2-year National Academy of Sciences study, absolutely absent from her book. And also she had misrepresented the glyphosate in breast milk studies as well. And she omitted two studies that contradicted her presentation on that. So I said, why did you ignore the science on that? And that's what I really wanted to know the most. And she gave an answer that was insufficient, and then they shut off my mic. So that's how that went.
So if I'm not being too blunt, I believe she said, well, you know, you the website that you wrote that review for is a partner of Monsanto. And I know you guys have debunked that at least 18 times in the last year. You've said, no, we don't take money from them. We don't collaborate with them. That's silliness. And so what do you think? And again, the clip is really short, but I got the impression of when she was answering you that she was like off base, like she wasn't prepared for you. And so I'm wondering what you thought of her response and how the audience responded to that interaction with her.
Well, it turns out the audience wasn't as informative as I'd hoped because it was really, really small, which actually part of that was because there was some kind of Red Sox game or something on. I don't follow sports ball, but apparently this is important to the locals. So there was something going on with the Red Sox. I think it was important. But it really was a small group of people there. And they were definitely the choir, essentially. So they were people who were already convinced that Monsanto was the devil and that Kerry was going to be right on everything. After I asked my question, she said something about the National Academy report wasn't about glyphosate. But I was able to show that, you know, there are lots of references to glyphosate in this. But that's when they shut off my mic. And then she did continue on with how Biofortified was supposedly this tool of Monsanto. And I said, that's not true, Kerry. So that stuff was happening in the room and other people were hearing it, even if it didn't make the recording, you know? So I felt like at least that was worth doing. You know, they can shut down scientists. They can take your mic away. But it was still worth doing in public, I think, and facing her on that, you know, because one of the things that I ask for from people all the time is if you saw Andrew Wakefield coming today. So Andrew Wakefield is the guy who published a terrible paper about vaccines and possibly links to autism years ago. It's been retracted since. He's been thrown off the medical register and on and on. But now we have different tools today. And if you saw Andrew Wakefield coming, what would we do about that? Would you go to one of his talks where he's talking to people? And would you ask him questions about what the science supports? Now, I would. And that, to me, that was the same kind of thing that I was doing. It was going to stand up in public and make this case. So that's what I was hoping to do with this.
Yeah. And kudos to you really, because that couldn't have been comfortable. I feel like I would have quite had fun talking to her about this kind of stuff, but it's not easy to do. I mean, to go into an audience, even a small one, that's hostile to you and thinks that you represent Satan, you know, that's challenging. So kudos on that. But a broader question then, what role does the media play in perpetuating misinformation and bad science about a topic like crop biotechnology? And Kerry is a good example because she was a really prominent reporter for Reuters, and she's good at doing that investigative angle when she frames her stories, because if she can make you think that Monsanto is burying data and paying off academics to write articles, which she's completely wrong about, which we've done a ton of research on at GLP. I'll link to that. But in any event, you know, what role, broadly speaking, does the media play in all this?
Right. And so in this case, like, doubt is her product, right? She's trying to seed doubt about the science and, you know, fog it up with conspiracy theories and everything. And that's why I wanted to ask her specifically about the science. But I think that in general, that is a problem with the media. The story can be crafted by crafty people who omit important things, for example, when she was at Reuters, she interviewed one of the drivers of the mother's breast milk glyphosate testing dramas, which was later shown to not be the case, but they were using terrible testing and on and on. But that the other scientific piece of it was left out. So you can craft a story where there's a concerned mother who really is upset about something, but it doesn't have the scientific foundation that it should, and that goes to press. And so it's possible to do two things: choose what stories you're going to tell. Now, it would have also been possible for Reuters to not cover that story. They could make that decision that this sort of story isn't sound scientifically, and maybe this is something that shouldn't get much airtime. So it's the choice of what story, and then letting people tell that story and omitting a lot of the details that might not fit the narrative that they want to tell. And I think that happened also recently. I was reading your piece on the pesticide case in the EPA and the EWG, was it, that
Center for Food Safety and neonics, the seed treatment pesticides that they're all freaking out about now.
Right. And so your piece was a good example of that. And so what happened was there was a legitimate tidbit of information, but all of the media left out the underlying details of that. And so the story and the narrative comes out as a headline that completely misrepresents what actually happened. And I think that's what's happening over and over again on these topics.
Yeah, and it's a fascinating case study. Thank you for mentioning it. So what we're talking about is a couple weeks ago, the EPA said that it had pulled the registration for 12 of these pesticides, and they ended up doing it as part of a lawsuit. And the manufacturers of those pesticides did it voluntarily to facilitate the lawsuit settlement. But the way the media ran with the story is they said, the EPA bans 12 bee-killing pesticides. And so if you don't know the background on this, we have a whole section on GLP about it. But basically, these pesticides, though toxic, they don't pose a big risk to pollinators like honeybees. It's just the nature of how much they're exposed to. And in fact, it's a big step in support of sustainable agriculture. But the way the activist groups like Center for Food Safety and others have gone after this is to say these chemicals are poisoning groundwater and they're killing bees and they're killing endangered birds and all this stuff. And so I don't know like what motivates it, because I emailed some of the journalists who had written those stories and I didn't get the impression that they were ideologues. I think sometimes it's really complex, you know, it takes time to understand it. And so when you combine that demand on your time with the fact that there's a very appealing story, you know, sometimes your gut as someone who wants to get an audience is just to write up what seems the coolest. What do you think about that?
I agree. And I think that and when they're relying on the press releases and the stories that they're seeing from activist groups, they are omitting some of the other details. And I do. I understand that journalism has deadlines that science is not used to, and that there are word count numbers that you have to meet that don't always allow you to go in depth in the issues. And that's certainly frustrating for those of us in science. It's not how we would like to have that conversation. And I do think it drives a different understanding in the public. I was actually just tweeting earlier today that there was a huge number of measles cases in the Ukraine, and the number was staggering, 100,000 cases of measles in the Ukraine in the last couple of years. And I was saying that if we can't win on measles, and measles is a really straightforward case, we know exactly what's wrong, we know exactly what the right mechanism is to prevent measles from spreading, and there's no debate about how to prevent it. There's support from all the public health agencies around the world. But if we can't even win on measles, we can't win on these complex issues of like agriculture and the trade-offs that you make during in agriculture, and the complexities of climate change or whatever, all of these big, massive scientific issues with that have both policy and other kinds of social implications as well. We're never going to be able to make any progress on these because of the complexity if we're dealing with a headline culture, you know?
Yeah, it's disappointing. One thing that gives me hope is, I should say our figures like Paul Offit, who is a medical doctor, and he's really spearheaded this whole response to the anti-vaccine crowd. And I actually interviewed him on this show. I'll link to that. But I think he's done a lot of good because he knows the science backwards and forwards, and he's a great communicator. And so I would ask him about stuff like that. I would say, you know, Dr. Offit, these people say that, you know, you need to do better studies. And he's like, yeah, they want you to do it in a lockbox underwater upside down, but you can't ever satisfy them. And I think just having someone that authoritative out in front of the public countering does some good. And that actually leads to my next question for you. I believe there's a study published even just last week that said that when you confront people with factual information, you can change their minds in certain cases. Mm-hmm. And I get the impression that you share that belief because you keep doing this. So I can't imagine you're doing it just because you're a masochist and you know, like.
Right. Well, there might be some of that too. Yeah. Well, I do think that There's a range of things you have to do to reach people. For example, I have pretty strong feelings about many topics, which people might notice if they follow me on Twitter. And it's not because I just decided that was my position. I came to that after reading in detail things like the scientific consensus documents and paying attention to the people who are practitioners of a field and hearing from farmers and so on. So I try to take quality information from a range of sources who are qualified to make comments on these things. So you can't just throw a meme at me and think that that's going to change my mind on something, because I didn't get there by just, you know, following some meme. I got there through evidence and reading and research. So, I'm someone that you have to argue with if you want to change my mind. And so I think there are people who you have to argue with to change their mind. There are some people who are going to be influenced by memes. Maybe, you know, there are great meme makers out there, and maybe that will be the thing for some people. I think there's different kinds of people out there. And I think that there's a range of ways to contact them and reach them. And one of the best things that I ever got involved with is something that nobody ever taught me in college. I got involved with Kyrkjestad is this group that makes these great animated informational videos on YouTube. And I was asked to help them out on their GMO script. So I worked on that with them, and I was astonished to see how many millions of people actually watched that. And it was great because it was appearing in lots of places that I would never have expected. I found it one time, I went looking to see where people had posted it. I found it one time in an article that was written by foodies who I wouldn't have expected to appreciate it, the GMO story before. And then there was another game discussion board. Somebody said, hey, this is a great video, you should watch this. So it was reaching out to an entirely different community that I would never have been able to reach. And that was a cartoon. So I think that's something that can work sometimes. And that, what I found, was kind of informational. And so that had facts in it. And it was presented in a different way, potentially, but it definitely was based on the facts on the ground. So this video was something that I was never trained to do, but I thought was really effective and reached more people than I ever would have imagined. But I was also, I read a lot about what kinds of science communication strategies might be effective. And I was engaged with John Cook, who's a climate communicator, with a Reddit Ask Me Anything sort of Reddit post that he had done. And I asked him about what is it with facts that the people think that facts are not essentially worthwhile in some of these discussions. And so one of the things that people say that is the deficit model is dead. You can't just give facts to people. And I understand that on some level, that just facts, bare facts alone, are not necessarily that effective. But he said to me, and I'll read it from the Reddit post, I can give you the link to this later as well. But he said, second, the topic of the deficit model, it bothers me how people claim that the deficit model has failed as if information doesn't matter at all. This is a case of deficit model doesn't do everything, reducing down to deficit model does nothing. Information does matter. Education matters. Telling people facts matters. They won't always work. They can even backfire in some cases. We need to recognize that communicating evidence is not going to give you 100% success, but it's also not going to give you 0% success rate. And so that's the end of that quote. So that's what I feel like, that there are times when using facts and evidence and things like the worldwide consensus on something is worth sharing with people who aren't aware of that. So I do think facts can help. But there's other times. Let me just mention another thing that he said in this post. He said, science communication is about psychology, and psychology isn't deterministic because people are complicated. It's probabilistic. That means that adopting tested science communication approaches increases your probability of success, but there's no 100% guarantee. When I encounter a hardcore denialist, he says, the approach I generally take is I will engage them on the assumption that they are not going to change their mind, and therefore my science communication isn't for their benefit, but for the benefit of the people watching watching the exchange. And on a personal level, I will say that it helps your own emotional state and demeanor. You can have a conversation with a frustrating science denialist without getting frustrated when you take that mindset. So assume you're not going to change the mind. That's the end of that quote, sorry. And so the assumption that you're not going to change the mind of some people is perfectly fine to go into the conversation with, and facts will never matter to those folks. We also talked a little bit about how values, people are telling me all the time that I have to share my values with some of the people who are arguing against certain issues. And I do. I value biology. Like we started in the beginning, I became a biologist because I love biology. I love living systems. And I value that. And I would like us to use less insecticide. And I know there's a way to do that with GMOs. And so I try to share that value. I would like to reduce insecticides too. How about we try this? But when you do that, you share that value, their values move to something else, like patents, for example. I say, well, okay, let's talk about making all of it freely available. If it was freely available, would you let farmers use GMOs? And then they move the goalpost to something else. So I've tried the shared values. I've tried facts. I've tried a whole range of things, and I that's what I think needs to happen. We have to try a whole bunch of different things because there's not one specific thing that's going to reach everyone. And I think a lot of science communication is trying to channel people into, oh, we have to talk to the anti-vaxxers this way. This is the way it's going to work. And it's obviously not working. And so I think we need to be open to, sometimes it's argumentative, sometimes it's cartoons, sometimes it's facts, sometimes it's Socratic discussions. There's all kinds of different ways that this can work. And I think that, especially in the age of social media, we just have to try everything.
All right, guys, that's going to do it for us this time. If you want to learn more about the podcast, check us out at geneticliteracyproject.org. Thanks so much. We'll see you next time.